The U.S. Army's 10th Mountain Division is among the most storied combat units in history. From its creation in the early 1940s, it was celebrated as a unit that enlisted champion skiers who'd fled from the countries of occupied Europe and ski bums from small New England hamlets in the Rockies. They trained for 3 years in the high mountains of Colorado, but didn't see combat until the war was almost over. By then, other U.S. troops were exhausted, but the 10th Mountain Division was ready for action against what were considered unbreakable German fortifications in Italy. McKay Jenkins, who was in the Department of English at the University of Delaware, has written a new book, The Last Ridge, the epic story of the U.S. Army's 10th Mountain Division and the assault on Hitler's Europe. He joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now from Helen, Georgia, is Dan Kennerly, who was a member of the 10th Mountain Division. Mr. Kennerly, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm proud to be here.
Mr. Kennerly, I've got to note the obvious. You don't sound like you're from a small New England hamlet.
No, I'm from the greatest spot in the world called Georgia.
Well, and how'd you wind up in the 10th Mountain Division, sir?
Well, it was when I was taking basic training, and we had a boy in there by the name of Don Murray from the Chicago area. He had already volunteered for the ski troops, and he wrote back what a great time he was having skiing and hunting elk on the weekends and that type of thing. So when we finished, they was going to give us the branch of service that we wanted. So I says, how about the ski troops? The fellow said, where are you from, soldier? I said, Georgia. He said, y'all ski in Georgia? I said, yes, sir. He said, what do you use to wax your skis with? I said, beeswax. So he said, well, I think you might make it. And I ended up in the ski troops.
Is it beeswax?
I don't think so.
Mr. Jenkins, let me turn to you. Is it beeswax?
No, I don't think it's ever been beeswax.
All right, okay. This unit was famous from the first, wasn't it?
They were famous from the minute they got started. They trained in a valley right next to the valley that now holds the Vail Ski Resort. And as soon as they got there, Hollywood was sending film crews out there constantly. These guys were on the cover of Time magazine 3 or 4 times, partially because the training was so kind of heroic in the kind of popular mindset. You had guys that they could shoot photographs of rappelling down cliffs or skiing in formation. This made great footage. They also had really famous people starting from scratch. They had expatriate Europeans, many of whom were world-class athletes. You had the world record-holding ski jumper, a guy named Torger Tokel from Norway. But on the other hand, you had people like Dan Kennerly, and another primary character in the book was a man named Dennis Noonan, who grew up in New Jersey. Noonan, before the war started, before he signed up with the mountain troops, said the highest he'd ever climbed was to the top of a Fifth Avenue bus. So you had enlisted men right alongside with world-famous mountaineers.
To take us back in history a while, there were people concerned that if the U.S. was going to be invaded, the land route, which can be very mountainous over Alaska to the Aleutian Islands, would be the obvious choice.
Right. As I was doing some research here, this is, I think, somewhat controversial, but I found documents that prove that some people in the military were also concerned that the Germans might invade through New England. And if they came through New England, history showed that people invading the United States would often come down through the Champlain Valley. So this is obviously didn't prove out to be true, but the idea was, what if they did? Would you not need some mountain soldiers to, say, occupy the Adirondack Mountains and defend people coming in from New England, coming down into New York?
Mr. Kennerly,
mm-hmm.
In addition to skis, could you tell me something else about the other paraphernalia you confronted that, for someone from Georgia, must have seemed a little unfamiliar?
We had the snowshoes. To me, they looked like oversized tennis rackets with no handles on them. And, of course, all the winter clothing I had never had any experience with. And then the way you have to take care of it, for example, you bed down at night, you had to put your inner soles out and put them behind your knees inside your long underwear. And then you put your socks next to your skin under your undershirt. And the next morning, they would be dry.
If I could add something, one of the things I found interesting in researching this book was that you had these men from alpine countries in Europe who were trying to convince the Americans to train in downhill skiing techniques. Then you had, on the other hand, men from Scandinavian countries who said, look, we have skied in war before. You don't need downhill technique. You need cross-country technique. What you're going to use skis for is to transport yourself from point A to point B to take out the enemy. Downhill skis are only useful if you're skiing down from on high on top of your enemy. In Europe, the Germans already occupy every point of high ground.
Venchi, of course, as you note, the 10th Mountain Division was deployed, and that's where I have to get you to begin to tell us the story of Riva Ridge.
Again, so here they are. They're training in Colorado year after year after year. Finally, the decision is made to go over and join the fight in Italy. So they get there, and it's about it's early February. It's getting into mid-February, and the decision is made to make a strategic move on a couple of mountains there. Mount Belvedere was very heavily defended by the Germans, but there was a ridge line just a little bit, a couple miles from Belvedere, that was about 6,000 feet high, and on top of this ridge were German observers, and everything that the Allies did around the base of Mount Belvedere, the Germans on top of Riva Ridge could see. So the 10th Mountain Division, after all these years of training and use of ropes and climbing technology, gets to the base of Riva Ridge, 750 10th Mountain Division men, and they had to climb up about 2,200 vertical feet up a very forbidding cliff face that was locked up in ice and snow in the darkness, with an order not to fire their weapons, because the element of surprise was the only thing they had going for them, without any idea of how many Germans were on the top of Riva Ridge.
Mr. Kennerly, we want to turn to you and then return to the narrative.
Okay. While the Riva Ridge attack was going on, we moved into the base of Belvedere and hid in the draws and crannies all day long. And then that night, we attacked Mount Belvedere. I've never seen an authentic war movie, and one of the reasons for it is that you don't have the odors and the blood in the movie that you have in real life. You got time for me to read you a little something out of my diary?
Please.
Okay. We've taken Belvedere, and we are going through the saddle where some of the main fighting started. Mm-hmm. Said we, excuse me, we displace our machine gun and follow A Company through the saddle. The evidence is clear as to what happened to C Company. Their bodies are scattered over the slope. They are lying everywhere, frozen in many different positions. Some have their arms and legs sticking straight up. Others remain in a firing position. They all have a pale yellow waxy color, like artificial fruit. There's a strong scent in the air. At first I cannot place it. Now it comes to me. It's the odor of a slaughterhouse. What I'm smelling is blood. Now the low point of the crest are 11 bodies in a row, chopped to pieces, and lying in every type of grotesque position. One has the top of his head shot off. His brains are spilled out onto the ground. Glancing into the cavity, I recognize the stump of the spinal cord. It reminds me of a watermelon with all the meat gone. Now I recognize the terrible nature of infantry warfare. The stark brutality overcomes me. I feel completely vulnerable. Surveying the gory scene in a trance-like gaze, I think to myself, this is not playing out a childhood fantasy of mock warfare or sitting in a theater watching a war movie. This is really happening, and I'm a part of it. I tremble. I want to drop all of my equipment and run to the rear, but I know I can't.
If you add to that, again, imagine that kind of warfare, something that Army soldiers experience on both sides all through Europe, in fact, all through history.
Oh, yeah.
But if you then add the fact that some of these guys that were getting cut up like this were, again, world-famous athletes.
Yeah.
Torger Tokel, the world record-holding ski jumper, was killed not long after this.
Yeah.
Now, in a division of what came to be about 15,000 men, he was the most famous, the most kind of mythical in his prowess. And from everyone I spoke to, that was the worst day of the war for them, that this kind of mythical figure could be cut down by a bullet.
It cut us bad, it did.
What does that do to the rest of your life, Mr. Kennerly?
Well, it makes me appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Every morning I wake up, I thank my lucky stars.
One thing that I've been struck by over the last few years as I've gotten to know these men, both personally and through their letters, is the remarkable modesty that they have. Again, in the face of a Hollywood machine that was trying to turn them into superheroes, they really remain very modest about their accomplishments. And when asked to talk about this, many of them say, look, we were in Italy for 4 months. There were Americans over there for 22 months. Talk to them. They're the ones that their story has never been written about.
Yeah.
So it's really for a group of men who were as famous as they were at the time and who went on after the war to become pioneers in the mountaineering and skiing industry, they really remain remarkably modest about it all.
Mr. Kennerly?
Uh-huh.
I guess the thought must flash through your mind that there are only a few reunions left of you guys who were together and so important to each other.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. We're getting thin, and you don't get any closer to anyone than your foxhole bait. In fact, I'll tell you another story. I had a buddy, Eddie Oatman, who was my squad leader at that time, and he was very persnickety about his personal hygiene, and he couldn't stand it because he didn't have a toothbrush. So I let him use my toothbrush for about a week. I said, what the hell, I may be dead tomorrow. It don't make any difference. Now, you can't get much closer than that, can you?
Mr. Kennerly, it's been good to talk to you, sir. Thanks. Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. Dan Kennerly from Helen, Georgia, who was a member of the 10th Mountain Division. And McKay Jenkins, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Jenkins is author of the new book, The Last Ridge, the epic story of the U.S. Army's 10th Mountain Division and the assault on Hitler's Europe. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.